When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, it's all about points. The points deductions facing Everton and Nottingham Forest after they were charged with breaching the Premier League's financial rules. Ivan Toney returns to action with a point to prove after being banned for 8 months. And Jose Mourinho, what's the point? We discussed the future of the special one after he was sacked by Roma. And chaps, what do points make? Pundits! And we've got three of the very best in very football. Good. Joining me, Tom Clark. Today we have the chief correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel, football correspondent for The Sunday Times, Jonathan Northcroft, and a former defender who, in the 2010-11 season for Chesterfield, had an impressive record of played 23, won 13, drew 5, lost 5, and kept 10 clean sheets. Gregor Robertson is here too.
He's just going to go through every season.
It's just a bit of a yin and yang, because I dug you out on Monday with a shocker of a season, and then I did manage to find one when you seemed to have a bit of an impact. So there you go.
But you won the league that year, yeah?
Yeah, exactly.
You get any player of the month? Like,
I won't go that far, John.
That's the one I've been searching for. I really want to say, like, you know, October's player of the league.
I think I want to go like the community player of the year award. You know, that's like the token gesture one at the end. So.
Yeah. No, that's the like man of the people one, isn't it?
Yeah. Did my bit in the community, you know?
Good lad. Well, moving on to more serious matters, only marginally more serious than Gregor's illustrious career. And hours after recording Monday's show, news broke about Everton and Nottingham Forest. Everton, of course, facing a second points deduction this season after being charged with another breach of the Premier League's financial rules, with Nottingham Forest also charged. As Martin Ziegler and Paul Joyce wrote, the Premier League's action is set to spark a new storm after it announced that Everton and Forest had both confirmed that they are in breach of its profit and sustainability rules for the three-year period ending 2022-23 season. In November, of course, Everton were handed a 10-point deduction for profit and sustainability breach after being charged last season. This was the biggest points deduction in Premier League's 30-year history, but they are appealing against this decision. Now, Martin, we had known about these potential charges for a while. Martin Ziegler and others had reported the potential for Forest to be charged and Everton as well. In your ST column at the weekend, which was kind of previewing this potential news, you kind of wrote, as you have done before, in the kind of guise of this is a bit rich because the rules are going to be changed. The headline, condemning Everton and Forest, a bit rich when the rules are set to be scrapped. Changing profit and sustainability rules in August is a tacit admission that in the present state they are no longer fit for purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell us more.
Well, you summed it up, basically.
Right, Johnny, moving on.
Yeah. You know, you summed it up. The thing is that the profit and sustainability rules will change in August. They'll be linked a lot more closely to UEFA's financial fair play rules. By its own admission, it means that they're not where they should be. And it's not about... it's not so much about prosecuting Everton or Nottingham Forest, because if the rules are there, and if you've broken the rules, you've broken the rules. It's going to be the same with Manchester City. It's about getting a sense of proportion in the punishment. Because if you're going to change the rules in 6 months' time because the rules no longer suit football as it is now, it seems completely unjust to give somebody a draconian punishment that will last long beyond this next 6 months, could change the future of the football club. Could bankrupt a football club, really, for something that you are going to change in 6 months' time to bring it up to date.
Mm.
You know, I mean, look, Kieran Maguire, who's a financial football analyst, wrote this week that if you actually updated PNS rules to reflect the money that is in football now, as opposed to the money that was in football in 2014 when they were made, the losses a club would be permitted over 3 years would be £218 million rather than £105 million. That's how different the financial landscape is. So why clubs are being deducted 10 points. And maybe if they were deducted 10 points again, Everton don't start with a 20-point deduction in one season.
Mm.
I don't care how good Sean Dyche is. So these are massive ramifications for these clubs for a set of circumstances that are going to change. Everton have already claimed that one of the reasons that they fell foul of PNS in the first place was that they changed the calculations to do with building stadiums and loans and interest and stuff. So it's just that you've got this evolving financial landscape and a set of rules that are now 10 years old. And on those rules, you're deducting 10 points. There's so many stages you could go through before you deducted 10 points.
So do you think the punishment is too harsh, or do you think there shouldn't be any punishment at all?
Well, look, you know what I think about financial limitations on owners investing, so that's a totally different point. But if you're taking, we must have rules, there should be profit and sustainability rules, you can't make the punishment as strong as this is, because they run about three red lights to get to 10 points, if you know what I mean. There's the one where it's a financial punishment to begin with. Then there's the one where you could have transfer embargoes for however many transfer windows. Then there's the one where you could deduct points on a level that people could see a way forward from it. You know, 4 points, a win and a draw, something like that. 10 points is huge. 10 points twice in a season is potentially ruinous for any club.
Johnny, your reaction to some of Martin's points, but also to the news in general?
Yeah, look, Martin sets it out very well. I think that what this whole affair has exposed has been a long-running issue, not just in English football, I suppose European football, which is the inability of FFP or PSR rules to manage things in any kind of satisfactory timescale. Because what we really need is sort of real-time regulation that stop clubs going bust, going to the brink. And we've got to remember that in this case, PSR rules came in the wake of Portsmouth, I think, who absolutely fell off a cliff financially in 2008, 2009. Premier League then realised they had to act. As Martin said, they adopted the UEFA system, having had their own FFP. I think the UEFA system initially was £5 million allowed losses, and then £30 million of owner investment per season. So that's where you get your 105, that's 3 times 35. And that was coming in around about 2009-10 and finally adopted 2013-14. And it's taken 10 years for somebody to actually be punished under those rules. And Everton's breaches go back to 2018. I think the current 10-point charge is from 2018 to 2021. And then this is 21-22, and this is last season. So, and the bulk of Everton's overspend, as it were, was in those early years of the Mashiri reign. So we're in a situation where, as Martin said, for sort of sins of the past, for a situation where the club has been put in a financial spot, in the sense that yes, Mashiri could afford it, but now he's walking away and he looks like he's selling to some owners, which their track record in sport and business isn't the greatest, let's be honest. And that's what we don't want in football. But these rules have not stopped any of that happening. And all they're going to do now is punish in retrospect the club for the actions of, let's say, Mashiri, who's about to leave, for Grant Inglis and Denise Baxendale Barrett, the execs in charge who dealt with the Premier League over this, gave Everton the impression that they were going to be fine, who have now left the club and wouldn't even represent the club in discussions or give evidence on their behalf. And then there's proportionality, as Martin said, where you've got a situation of a having nobody ever having been punished, a club being punished 10 points for going £18 or £19 million over, and then facing double jeopardy, facing a second set of charges, which is the ones they're gonna face now. All of it shows that the system's broken. The Premier League know that. I think next month the Premier League meeting is gonna, it looks like they're gonna ratify the new changes that Martin outlined, which is bringing in, because UEFA have moved on, a UEFA style, basically a wages to turnover ratio, which on the surface does seem more of a real-time monitoring thing. But the Premier League are so far behind on this, and that's before we even get to Chelsea being investigated for stuff in the early Abramovich era, and Manchester City's 115 going back to 2008-9, is it?
2008-9.
The rules aren't, they're not working. They're not doing what they're set out to do, and Everton are caught in the middle of it now.
Yeah, so we do feel Everton have been harshly treated here.
10 points was too much, and the idea of double jeopardy is an anathema to natural justice. And the final point, sorry, I should have made about this whole, the length of time this takes. Everton are appealing the 10 points, and that won't be heard until, I think, next month at the earliest. Mm. They can't deal with this case until the appeal's held. And the projection is that the Premier League getting a rule in May on this, maybe even after the season finishes, but certainly last week of the season in May. So clubs will go into the relegation fight not knowing what the situation is.
I was just about to say, sorry, Greg, I was just about to just clarify, when John's talking about double jeopardy, two of the seasons that Everton are being done for on this second occasion are seasons that they've already been concerned with the 10 points.
Yeah.
So that's the double jeopardy. You're being done for the same offence twice, which just doesn't seem right.
So it's a rolling 3-year period.
Gregor, your former club, Nottingham Forest, obviously charged this time. Charlotte Dunker writing after the news broke that a kind of piece looking at the kind of bit slightly carefree spending that has gone on, with a piece headline, Nottingham Forest owners acted like children in a sweet shop, from signings without staff's approval to deadline day splurges. The club's breaching of profit and sustainability rules is indicative of careless recruitment. I assume you would agree with all that assessment.
Yeah, I mean, I want to see Forest do well. They're a club that's, you know, I have affection for still, but I have very, very little sympathy for Nottingham Forest. They've signed 130 players since 2017.
Wow.
So there was this sort of, because of the promotion, I feel like, you know, and I hope Forest fans will take this in the right way, there was like a bout of collective amnesia about what had gone before. This isn't chaos that happened when they got into the Premier League. And although that's more relevant now because of, as I say, the 3-year rolling period, but it was chaos from minute one. The churn of players and managers and staff, everything was always there, and then they lucked out with Steve Cooper. Mm. And then the chaos continued. They spent 150 million in the first summer. They've been run really, really badly, and I think continue to be.
Mm. So you don't necessarily feel like the guys were saying about Everton, maybe with the double jeopardy, this one, you don't think there's necessarily an unfairness?
All these things are quite nuanced, because I've also seen people make the point that surely the financial year should run in tandem with the transfer window if it's going to be so important, because they're talking about the Brennan Johnson fee. You know, they held out for a larger sum. Look, if you're getting to that stage and that's what you're dependent on, I think it says a lot about the way you run the club. Mm. That's the first thing to say. But it's a valid point that's something that should be looked at going forward. Just coming back as well to the kind of proportionality of the punishment, like Johnny referenced the last time we spoke about this, like Leicester cut their cloth accordingly, and we're relegated as a result. Basically, you look at Aston Villa, you know, everyone's saying Aston Villa should be able to compete now. They've been quite smart. They sold two of their most highly rated academy players for like 25-30 million quid in the summer, and inserted buyback clauses. They did that to comply with FFP. That was a part of their plan. They think we could get them back in future if possible. So there's been no wit, no intelligence in the way either Everton or Forest have been run. And so for that reason, I honestly have very little sympathy. Well, I have limited sympathy for them.
I'm glad Gregor raised that, because when I say the rules are broken, and we are expressing sympathy for Everton in particular, maybe less so for Forest here, but we have to have sympathy for the Leicesters of the world, for Tottenham, you know, for Liverpool, for Aston Villa, for everyone that's complied with them, for Crystal Palace. because they're broken for everyone. So the, all those clubs who've worked hard to try and stay within the rules, and it, it arguably did mean the collapse of Leicester's model, players leaving, players getting dissatisfied because other players were leaving. It's meant Aston Villa have had to be clever, Newcastle having to go through a period of trying to grow within a almost a straitjacket of rules. We've got to have sympathy for them as well. There's such an outpouring for Everton, and that's right, you know, because I think it's because you can see there's a fan base that have really suffered, and they've suffered from their owners, they've suffered from bad recruiters, they've suffered from bad managers, they've suffered from underperforming players, and they've probably just suffered from wrong place in history at the wrong time, wrong point to have a sort of trough. But you've got to be sympathetic to the other clubs as well. But John, a new system needs to come in that's going to protect everybody.
But John, all I would say is it's not about, I don't think, pitching Everton against Leicester or pitching Leicester fans against Everton fans and Nottingham Forest fans against Aston Villa fans or whatever, because the whole system is wrong. Leicester should never have been relegated. Leicester should never have had to comply with a completely artificial construct that has not moved with the times. Newcastle should not have to comply with that. Aston Villa are now talking about selling players. I take your point, Gregor, but why should Aston Villa have to let two of their kids go, even with a good buyback clause? They're not skint Aston Villa. The owners have got money. You know, you've produced those kids. Why are they with somebody else? It's not right. It's not fair. It's not actually needed. Portsmouth was a long time ago. I'll get rid of the Portsmouth problem in one fell swoop. Owners have to give gifts, not loans. Owners have to invest, not loan. Right? And that does with Portsmouth. But what happened was Portsmouth was used to make owner investment rather than debt the big problem. It was used to flip FFP on its tail, basically, and it became about something that actually is quite healthy for the game, which is an owner who wants to invest in the football club. Gregor's point notwithstanding, there's sensible ways to do it and there's bad ways to do it, but there's always been good and bad owners. That's how clubs move up and down the league.
My only thing about this idea of moving with the times and this, you know, what Kieran Maguire suggested, it should be allowed to lose £218 million. Why should that be tied to the amount of money in football? Mm-hmm. Like, surely the amount of money coming to football has risen. You cut your cloth accordingly to that. It doesn't mean you just lose more money. Mm-hmm. And, like, football is its own, like the thing that's really inflated, we have to be honest, the thing that's really inflated spending in football, like, first of all, it was TV money, then it was the arrival of an oligarch in West London, then it was, you know, largely US private equity, and now it's everyone trying to keep up with a nation state.
Yeah.
What's inflated spending. That's why everyone has to spend more and lose more to catch up.
But who do you want to have the money? This is what I don't get. You see, 208 million, if you're allowed to lose 208 million and then owners are going to, you know, maybe invest a bit more and, oh, we're going to get into an arms race or whatever. But actually, it's meant to be fun. It's meant to be this competition. It's meant to be. I don't mind the idea of very rich men amusing the working class by chasing a dream. I really don't mind that. And I tell you the part of football where I really would be very interested to look at the finances. You go back to when there was a maximum wage and there were 70,000 people in the stadium, the most anyone could earn was £8. Where did the money go then? Who got the money then? Because it wasn't the players and the fans were still paying to get in. So who got the money? Now, I don't think that's a great business model either, where, you know, someone sits around and never has to put their hand in their pocket. What's happening at the moment is quite good fun.
Look, I do fundamentally agree with that point, but we still need some kind of rules, not just about sustainability, but about competitive balance. I think we do.
Totally.
There's a brilliant interview in a rival outlet today with Javier Tebas, who's an interesting character, the head of the Spanish league. Brilliant, because he's colourful and he expresses himself in quite amusing ways. But the thing that really comes through is the impossibility of being in charge of Spanish football when you've got Barcelona and Real Madrid, in particular Real Madrid, who are mighty at the moment, Barca in financial difficulties. But he basically says in this interview, I have had to spend my career trying to run the league for the benefit, or rather try and do what's best for 40 clubs, because the two others in the 42 will not do anything for the rest. And that's the reality. If you don't fetter the spending in some way, or you don't have some kind of balancing mechanism, you are in danger of having big clubs that are so uber dominant. And we've got more big clubs in this country than Spain or Germany. But you cannot have equally a system where there's five or six who are just so wealthy that nobody else can compete,
well,
in my opinion.
Totally agree.
Protecting that big six leads me on to the next question, which is a listener question from Tony McMullen, who, as well as saying he enjoys hearing a new fact about Gregor Robertson's playing career on each episode, said he also had a question mainly for you, Martin, but I'm sure everyone can answer it as well. He said, having read a lot of your pieces that talks about profit and sustainability and how it often essentially just protects those big six clubs, he wants to know why haven't the Premier League clubs outside that big six simply voted to abolish them? Because it would have then helped the likes of Leicester, as we talked about before.
Yeah, because they're not very bright sometimes. Some of them, you get clubs. I can remember West Ham voting for the FFP rules right at the time when they're absolutely ripe for being taken over by somebody, a wealthy guy. They've got this 60,000 capacity stadium, which they fill, and they voted against it. And they voted for FFP, and you're thinking, what are you doing, you crackers? And they think that it rains teams in, it rains the big teams in. But the fact of the matter, it doesn't rain the big teams in. It actually, Everton are not as saleable in the current climate. The guys that have bought Newcastle, the Saudi Arabians who've bought Newcastle, you'd be very interested in speaking to them now and seeing if they've got exactly what they thought they were getting, or whether they thought they could go for it the way that Manchester City went for it. And we're
Kylian Mbappe.
Yeah, and we're about to find out whether how Manchester City went for it was legal or not. But I wonder if the guys that bought Newcastle would now look back and go, actually, this is not as advertised. Mm. People like Steve Parrish at Crystal Palace, have talked about it in the past as, it reins people in. But you hear Steve Parrish talk about it now, and he's coming up with different ideas, different ways of doing it. That was the only financial control on offer in answer to the question. That was the only... when people say... why didn't they all vote against it? Well, they wanted some form of financial control, and that was the only form of financial control on offer, so people voted for it. You've got to remember, UEFA's FFP is brought in to control Chelsea. Forget Man City. Everyone thinks it's all about Man City. Man City wasn't even on the radar when they were talking about financial controls at UEFA, Platini and people like that. Man City, it predates Sheikh Mansour. The club that everyone was worried about was Chelsea. By the time it was put to the test and put to the vote, Roman Abramovich was a fan of FFP. Now, you've got to ask yourself, if that was the FFP that everyone was thinking of, if Roman Abramovich actually voted for it in the end and was saying to Platini, we need financial controls. No, what he wanted, he didn't want financial controls. What he wanted was, I want to pull the drawbridge up because I'm in the castle now, and I don't want anyone else to get in the castle.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back. That's an excellent answer, Tony. I hope you got what you wanted there. We'll come back to the big teams because I think that we do need to talk about them. But Gregor, it was kind of alluded to in the discussions before. We talk so much about projection and narrative in football these days. As much as we're getting into the, very into the depths of what these charges mean and the reality of them, is there an aspect, do you think, of when we think of the likes of Macclesfield, Bury and teams down the Football League, do you think there's an element of presenteeism about these charges and the potential points deductions, just that for the little guys, they'll be looking and going, finally, they're doing one of the big guys. Finally, the big guys are going to pay.
Well, there have been those sort of hierarchical debates in the Football League, as you alluded to. Macclesfield were one when they were the first club to be, I think, got points for failing to pay wages. I mean, lots of clubs in the Football League over the years have failed to pay wages. They were dot points, and ultimately it doomed them. And you know, Bolton were one club in the same season did the same and weren't. And there, you know, there were there's nuance to all of this, because it's about the way that the owners engage with the governing body as well. But absolutely, I think there's always going to be a sort of feeling that there are some fruits that are more ripe than others to pick. And look, that's what ultimately a lot of Everton fans are arguing now with Manchester City. But it is in fairness a very different set of circumstances. And if you're going to take on Manchester City, like with everything we know that Manchester City have said and feel about this process, then they want to do it right.
Yeah, well, talking of Manchester City, the Premier League chief executive Richard Masters has revealed a date has been set to deal with Manchester City's charges, but we won't tell you what it is. The alleged 115 rule breaches that City are alleged to have made. But when it comes to the timings and things, and we think about how long this has been going on, Martin Ziegler again writing this week, the investigation into City began in December 2018, with charges brought in February last year, while Chelsea have been under investigation for 18 months for payments made during Roman Abramovich's ownership. It has been reported that City's hearing has been scheduled for October, which would mean the process may not be completed well into 2025. Johnny?
Yeah, I found that answer pathetic. I really did. Yeah. And last night, and this is how my life's a bit less fun than it was in my 20s, probably. I sat through the select committee. I didn't see it at the time, so I watched it last night while trying to watch a bit of Forest Blackpool. And, I mean, I think throughout, Masters came across as evasive, as cold, and was, I think Rick Parry ran rings around him. I mean, they just couldn't pin him down on an answer as to why, 4 years on, the Premier League haven't come up with a new deal yet, agreed the new deal yet. But rather than, I mean, I don't think he's an impressive performer, but I don't want to vilify him as an individual, other than to say, who are the Premier League? The Premier League are the clubs. So Richard Masters has got actually an impossible job of trying to speak on behalf of all these warring clubs. And he's probably not doing a great job of it, but I have sympathy for that job. But the idea that Man City, don't worry about it, it's all in hand, we've got a date, not going to tell you when the date is, it's probably going to be 2025. In the meantime, let's hammer Everton and Forest. The optics, as they say, are not good on that.
Mm. When there are so many conflicting interests in football, in a league and in between leagues, I know Martin will hate to hear this, but it makes the case for an independent regulator even all the stronger.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're heading towards solutions because I do think it'd be nice to finish with some solutions in terms of what we think could be better than what we've got already. Gregor, is independent regulator what you'd go for?
I'm not saying it's going to be perfect, but I think ultimately it's been a failure that football clubs trying to kind of police themselves and look after themselves, look after each other. It's failed. It'll never work.
So you think you need an outside governance?
I do. I know it's going to be complex, and I'm not sure. I don't think there's a perfect, you know, there's no panacea, but I feel that absolutely that would be a better situation.
Martin?
I mean, I would not trust that Rick Parry sat there in front of this lot again and said that 2/3 of the clubs in the EFL will go bust unless we get another figure that's been plucked out of the air. The first one's plucked out there, the second one's plucked out there, all plucked out there. When have 2/3 of the clubs in football ever gone bust? That's 48. Mm. That's 48. So two whole divisions are going to go bust. Yeah, it's a lie.
That's alarmist nonsense, yeah.
It's alarmist nonsense. So
you could say 2/3, you could say more than that are in serious debt.
You could say 2/3 of them are doing no good financially. Mm. Yeah, you 2/3 of any of the restaurants in the country that, you know, are doing no good at any stage, but the entire restaurant industry isn't about to go bust. So arguments are being picked up plucked out of the air. And my problem with the independent regulator, as everyone on here knows, is if that's the standard, if you look at what's wrong with the Premier League at the moment, you've got an independent regulator. You've got independence already. You've got a very weak chief executive in Richard Masters, and you've got independence surrounding him. And all they're doing, if you pardon my language on here, everybody, is covering their arses. That is all they are doing. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what went wrong with the post office, it was a load of people at the top covering their arses. Because when things started to unravel there, no one was bold enough to stand up and go, "No, this can't be wrong. We can't suddenly have got 1,000 postmasters on the take or overnight all of a sudden." No one had to, because they're all independent and they're all covering their arses. So I've said it three times now.
Lots of arses and arses are not on board with the regulator. But what do you think, as a kind of pro, what would your suggestion be?
I would have firm, hard rules of the type that football is too terrified to have. How has the EFL...
Give us a for instance.
You could take back Reading now. If you can't pay the wages, if you default on the wages, the Football League.
And the Football League is the clubs, though, Martin. That's the point.
And you put it under administration.
Independent regular may be able to do that.
No. The Football League can. If you put it into the statute books, if you fail to pay your players, we have the right as the Football League to take your club and to put it into administration. That's what we have the right to do, right? You start producing hard rules, fast rules. That bad ownership is that owner investment isn't the problem. Owner uninvestment, disinvestment, call it what you like, misinvestment. That's the problem.
So what would you?
So they should be able to take that club back off Guy Young now.
So what would your punishments have been for Mashiri? They would have been back in time, there would have been quicker, more reactive punishments.
Yeah, absolutely. But look, Mashiri has done is invest badly. You know, you're allowed to invest badly. There's no such thing as, you can't pass a rule against being a bad owner. You can't pass a rule against not knowing who a good left back is or buying four of them and they're all useless. Mm. You can't pass a rule against that because that's how football clubs move up and down the pyramid. You know, they make bad buys. They, you know, spend £1 billion on players and forget to sign a centre forward. Things like that. That's always got to be allowed. If you can't pay the players, you shouldn't be running the football club. And you should have the power to go, right, we take your football club back, we are going to put it on the market, and these are the administrators we will appoint to run it until such a time as we can sell it.
Johnny, independent regulator, hard and fast rules. You've been sat in the corner listening to all of this. You're going to come up with a culture dancer, aren't you?
I'm not sure.
Culture? culture? Yeah. It was passionate. It just wasn't uncultured.
You two, coming here
getting salted.
I've got a polo neck on. I'm cultured.
That's true. Yeah. To be fair, Martin's got a polo neck on.
Look, I think what Martin's talking about, there's a club licensing system. I've heard that. I think it's a good one where you wouldn't buy the club, you'd buy the license, as it were.
Difficult in law, too, though.
Very difficult in law. This is where we are, though. But the license could be taken away from you if you're not paying your wages or whatever.
By an independent regulator.
But you're not closing the club down, John. That's all I mean. You're not closing the club down. You're saying these people will now run your club.
That's an American-style system, and there is a lot of logic to that. But it would, as Gregor said, it would be a fundamental redesign. The thing about the regulator is it's been pushed as a kind of either-or, and I think we're still hearing this binary idea. And Gregor's right. The Premier League is failing... And the Football League has failed to look after itself because clubs can't be trusted to look after themselves, basically. But a regulator is still going to have problems to sort out. So it's getting to those problems. And I would say that they are distribution, absolutely key. Premier League, it's equitable, but it needs to be more equitable. So divide the Premier League prize money up equally. You could do that tomorrow. And that would help clubs... lower down, the top clubs still get to play in European competition, and that's where they make their advantage. And basically, owners and executives having to answer for their actions. And one of the things about this Everton thing, as I said, is the idea that the execs behind it can just walk away, never have to answer a question, which is very much post office scandal-esque. And the owner... We don't know. He doesn't talk. He does talk, it's bizarre. But you know, it doesn't feel that owners have to answer for anything, and whatever mechanism, it's got to be distribution, it's got to be people in charge answering for stuff.
I was just going to say
there's a thing that people coming back to as well is this idea of of it being, you know, clubs having to, or owners having to deposit money in a sort of escrow account as well. Mm. So it's like, the money's already there otherwise.
Yeah.
In other words, sorry. I think that would be almost impossible outside the Premier League. Wait, I don't think, I think the number of people wanting to buy football clubs, particularly in the Football League, would diminish greatly. And that, you know, in some cases, that'd be a good thing. But not everyone has, you know, if Manchester United's wage bill's £300 million or whatever, you know, somebody has to deposit a lot of money and money for that they're going to spend in the transfer market and whatnot.
To very quickly put it another way and echo that, we're all worried about Mashiri at the moment. What we should be worried about as much as Mashiri is 777. But amidst all of this, nobody's looking at who the next people are. Mm. And that's where football fails time and again.
The other thing I was just about to say, because whenever this is whenever we discuss things like this, I always come over some laissez-faire free market capitalist lunatic.
So, in your role, Nick.
Yeah, exactly.
Fiorentino Perez. Or
So, yeah, exactly. So I would just like to say, and I have written this, so anyone's been reading it, I have written this. I am very much in favour of wealth redistribution in football. But people only ever see it as the Premier League and the EFL. The biggest corrupting influence in financing football is the money that comes in from UEFA and the money that will come in from FIFA into the Club World Cup and the sort of monies they are guaranteeing clubs. So no one cares about football in New Zealand, or, you know, probably listen to this podcast. There may be one or two, but I do apologise for anyone who cares about football in New Zealand.
Winton Rufus.
But if you look at the next Club World Cup and think what FIFA are guaranteeing participants in that, and think what that amount of money will do if given to one club in New Zealand. That's the end of the domestic league. As it has been in various parts of Europe, including Germany, which had a league exactly like ours that had never been won by a team any more than three times, and what are Bayern Munich now, 11? And that's all to do with UEFA money coming in. So the first thing I would do, and it's never going to happen because you're never going to get the big clubs to vote for it.
You can do it on this podcast.
But you know, while we are living in a fantasy world of let's try and get football perfect, is that the money that comes in from UEFA should be tipped far more to giving it to the league rather than to two or three clubs within that league, and then that brings the domestic competition closer together. Whereas at the moment, if you look at what is given to the actual individual clubs as opposed to what is given as the solidarity payment to the rest of the league, it's nothing. It's nothing. There's tens and tens of millions between it. But if you ever tried to do it, all of the major clubs of Europe would break away straight away. That's what they would do. So you are hamstrung by it. But if we are talking in an ideal world, then that's the way you try and bring everyone closer together. And then that makes it a lot easier to knock that payment on down towards the EFL, down towards Leagues 1 and 2 and everything like that. And then you try to aim for competition. But it won't happen because that starts at the very top and turkeys don't vote for Christmas.
I'll just add one thing. It's slightly kind of, it's related, but it's, I fundamentally don't trust, the other thing about self-police is I don't trust the owners of Premier League football clubs and actually the direction of travel too. You know, how many American owners are there now in the Premier League, and it's going to be growing, and like, a different view, a different kind of vision of what sport is really. And If we're still talking about, you know, one vote, one club, we're heading down a path where you actually lose control a little bit as well. So it's all related. But I don't trust the clubs to police themselves, and I think it's only going to get worse rather than better.
No trust, loss of control, lots of problems and some solutions. There you go. You got the full package on the Game podcast.
No solutions that anyone would ever vote for.
But if you listeners have got any ideas on football's financial future, you can get in touch with me, or perhaps you've got a question for one of our journalists, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Stick with us. We're going to be talking about Ivan Toney and Jose Mourinho next.
Hold up. One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Martin Samuel, Gregor Robertson and Johnny Northcroft. Now, there might only be two matches in the Premier League this Saturday, but there's one man who is very excited about January the 20th, and that is Ivan Toney. He will return to action for Brentford against Nottingham Forest after 8 months out after being banned for betting offences. Gregor, you've written an excellent piece which you can read on The Times website now about what the striker has been up to during his time out. Tell us a bit more.
He's been...
Get for dogs.
Yeah, you know, a lot of holidays. No, I mean, when the ban was first announced, I think he's spoken about how it kind of it took a toll on him and his family. There were a lot of doubts, a lot of anger. I think he was aggrieved by the sort of severity of the punishment, if he's being honest with himself now. But after that, he took it upon himself. There was a 4 month period where he wasn't even allowed to set foot in Brentford's training ground, which, you know, Gareth Southgate was one of many, many voices of sympathy regarding that decision. And during that time, he did several things. He enlisted the work of the service of a personal trainer. He went out to work with Alan Russell, the former England striker coach out in Nashville. Went out there, I think, three times. And I spoke to a coach out there who watched Toney taking his penalty kicks, and he told me that he takes them from he practices from 13 yards, not 12.
Wow.
And when he asked him why, he said, well, you get to match day and the goal looks bigger. So that was quite an interesting wee kind of nugget about his sort of mindset. Mm. But then he returned to training in September in really good shape, and it was a big boost to everyone at Brentford. He's played in four B team games. He scored a hat-trick recently, Panenka penalty, so his confidence isn't dimmed. And he's done a surprising number of sort of interviews actually recently. Mm. He spoke to Sky Sports. He's done an interview with he did an interview with the Diary of the CEO podcast, and sort of the thing that just always strikes you with him is his like unwavering belief that he will play at the top level.
Because you've interviewed him in the past, yeah, and he said exactly that, didn't he?
I was going to say I interviewed him just after he signed for Brentford. So the season before, he was playing for Peterborough in League One, and he just signed for Brentford, and he said he wanted to play for England. And that's the kind of thing that, he said he's going to play for England. Mm. He's not, I want to, he thinks, I believe I will play for England. Mm. I believe I'll play in the Champions League. And that kind of thing often strikes you of a player at that level as sort of posturing.
Mm. But I remember you ringing me in about it and going, well, he's not shy of a bit of confidence, this lad.
He always kind of struck you that he meant it, you know. Yeah. And I think ultimately, you know, even this week he's sort of doubled down on his belief and his desire to play for a top club challenging for trophies, I think he said, you know, Champions League. He said that he didn't rule out leaving this month, which, given all the support that Brentford have given him during the last 8 months, some fans might not be entirely pleased about.
Yeah.
I think they accept he's going to leave, but they definitely want him now that they're in trouble and 3 points above the relegation zone. They definitely want him to help them survive this season. But it's just, that's the way he's always been. He's even throughout the kind of the difficulties of the last 8 months, his focus has been he said he's envisioned standing in the tunnel and on Saturday, and the number one thing in his head will be score goals, make up for lost time. And I wouldn't put it past him doing that.
John, are you really excited to see Ivan Toney back in action?
Really excited. Not just from a fantasy football point of view, but I was having this discussion with another journalist at St James's Park on Saturday, where Alexander Isak was sensational against Man City. But before the game, we'd said there's never been a bigger drop off between the best striker in the Premier League and the next best. Mm-hmm. You know, after Haaland, who has the best number nine? And we basically came up with what's probably the guy that's not even playing. It's probably Ivan Toney. Could be Isak, but he gets injured a lot, and maybe Ollie Watkins. But that's why the competition needs him back. There's a dearth of operators in that position, and he's got there slowly, but he's certainly one of the very best around. It's fascinating as to whether he's going to stick with Brentford, or rather, it's fascinating what Brentford do, whether they keep him for the relegation fight, and they could probably do with knowing what Everton's points deduction is going to be, but that's another thing. Or do they cash in? And if they keep him, how does that affect his mentality? There's a lot riding on this. But as Gregor sort of explains, he's the thing that strikes you watching Toney is the sort of swagger, the good swagger that he's got of a guy that loves being the number nine, loves being the main man of a team. And one of the memorable matches I covered last season was him at the Emirates, where he got hammered by the Arsenal fans, and he loved it, absolutely loved it. And players like that are just a joy to watch.
Yeah. What do you think Brentford do? You talk about the kind of issue that they've got to decide here, and there's been talk about them saying, oh, it'll take a stupid money offer, 100 million, etc., for us to sell him. But then the risk of losing him for free, as you say, probably the second best or the second most wanted striker in the Premier League. That's quite a gamble, isn't it?
Well, Brentford are, I think we know what they do really, which is, I mean, they're a money ball club, if you want to use that lazy term. So they sell at the right price. They know what that price is, and they sell, and it's quite a cold matter. But what they should do is probably keep him. Mm.
I think what they've done, the reason they've allowed him to speak so freely in the last few weeks and months, is that they kind of acknowledge if they do get a silly offer, that they'll take it. But the likelihood of that is probably quite slim, given all the financial constraints we've spoken about, and whether anyone's going to spend that on a striker. Although it's a proven striker, in January. So I think it's unlikely someone will pay the money that they would accept. But as Johnny says, there's always a point where they will accept it.
What do you think it is? What do you think the price is?
Maybe 80 million.
Because there's a scarcity, isn't there? For that type of player.
Well, it'd be fascinating to see what happens in terms of transfers. But looking at the international situation, obviously Ivan Toney, Martin, was very upset to miss the World Cup as part of his ban, and understandably so. Do you think he has a point to prove in terms of the things Greg is talking about, ready and raring to go? Or is he already, even having not played, in good contention for the Euro squad?
No, I think he's got to come back and show that the time away from football hasn't dulled his fitness at all, and dulled his sharpness, and dulled his capability to score goals at an elite level. That's the one thing that we don't know. That's the one thing that one would imagine Arsenal or Chelsea or any of his potential suitors at the moment are looking to see. What if we were to go in the January transfer window? And again, as we just pointed out, there's a lot of reluctance to go in the January transfer window because no one wants to be deducted 10 points. But at the same time, you would be looking to see, does he come back sharp? Does he look like a guy that needs, I don't know, a month of matches before he's back to where he was? And Gareth Southgate will be looking at that, because all the world over, there aren't that many matches between now and the European Championships. I would imagine Gareth would be looking to get him into the squad if he comes back and hits the mark straight away. He will be included in England's squad for matches against, I want to say, Belgium and Brazil in March.
Sounds about something like Brazil.
Yeah, and then you go from there.
I should say that he didn't miss the World Cup because of the ban. It was like the allegations came out beforehand.
Sorry, the allegations.
Yeah. And he was banned subsequently. Yep. The one thing is, as well, we should say is that it's been a long process. And even, you know, there was a long process when he was still playing and playing well and scoring goals. And as Johnny said, he was the best striker in the country behind Erling Haaland and Harry Kane, who's now left. So that in itself is quite a sort of, you know, a glowing indictment of his mindset.
I think I know the answer to this question, given what you've just said, but both on their day, Ollie Watkins or Ivan Toney?
For England?
Yeah.
I've said this. I think I would take Toney because of his impact and because he's the best, he's the best in the air in the whole league. I actually think Watkins is a little bit more similar to Kane in profile, but I still would take Toney.
Johnny, Toney or Watkins? I know he could take both, but it's not as fun to say he can take both.
It's a great question because it's basically coming down to having something different, which is Ivan Toney, or something in Ollie Watkins. He could play, he could deputise for a number of positions. And I love Ollie Watkins. I think Toney is.
Can he play for Scotland?
Definitely could, yeah. I mean, God, we could have one of them, couldn't we? I'd probably take Watkins just as all round everything. But as a pure number nine, Toney's.
No, you've said it now. You've picked Ollie Watkins. Martin.
This puts me in the sort of head judge.
It does.
Position, doesn't it? I'll sit completely on the fence here and say that I'll wait to see what Ivan Toney looks like when he comes back. Yeah. I'm not going to say, I'll pick Ivan Toney and he comes back and he looks.
If he comes back as good as he was. If he comes back as good as he was,
you probably go with Ivan Toney, I would imagine. But then again, if you're looking at the guy that has got the best scoring record outside of, with no penalties at the moment, is Jarrod Bowen. Bowen's scoring record, bearing in mind the man doesn't take penalties, is absolutely exceptional. He makes him the best striker in the country on form at the moment. If you take away the penalties. Goals from open play.
Well, I had Bowen in definitely. That's why you had to choose between Watkins and Toney.
Mate, I'm not saying I would have Jarrod Bowen in necessarily either. We don't have to make the decision yet. It's January.
Yeah, exactly. There'll be plenty more England squad discussions and debates coming up, I'm sure. Well, Ivan Toney might be back, but one man with the weekend off is Jose Mourinho, sacked this week by Roma. Tom Allnutt's piece about Mourinho and his time at Roma is absolutely fascinating. It's well worth your time. If you search for Tom Allnutt and Jose Mourinho on the Times website, you will find it.
Everything in flames, as it usually does.
Well, slightly, but also before the flames, there was...
It's like the last scene of Barton Fink, virtually.
We're into the film area of the podcast. There was the fact that Mourinho was the best paid coach in Serie A and Roma owned the third highest paid squad in the division. But even with that, Mourinho had achieved only six place finishes in successive seasons and failed to qualify for the Champions League. So crucial to the club staying clear of financial regulations, of course. Johnny, where are we at with Jose now in the kind of the narrative trajectory of his career?
Well, I think what strikes me is he's just becoming an ever more extreme version of himself. Mm. You know, he's going further down the Jose Mourinho road, and the Roma episode, because they're all kind of episodes in his story, really, aren't they? He never stays long. It was almost like Jose plus, because what he does is he goes somewhere, he divides people instantly, but he creates incredible tribal loyalty among those who think he's great. I think he got 5 red cards in his time. It's incredible.
Sunday was the 16th game that he's missed. A touchline ban.
And amid it all, the thing that strikes, I guess the point is that all the fireworks of Jose Mourinho happen off the pitch these days, and on the pitch what you get is pretty kind of stasis, really. It's not great football to watch, and it's not really winning football. It's winning football up to a point, which is, you know, what he did, 6th place Europa Conference League. But that's for Roma. I don't know, it's when there's debates as to whether you have to be a Roma fan and say if that's good or not. But
well, you talk about Roma fans. In Tom Allnutt's piece, he mentions how at the training ground they all gathered to say goodbye and wave him off, and it seemed to them that the kind of the fireworks that Martin mentioned and going up in flames and things, they seem to quite like that.
Yeah, because he tapped into Rome, which is a brilliant city, mad city. Definitely tapped into Rome in that sort of visceral way. But he is becoming the man for those jobs now. I don't know where his next club is, but it's. I don't know who is crying out for a
arsonist.
And that's exactly
Ryan has got this phrase about Nicolas Cage being 100% Nicolas Cage 100% of the time, and that's sort of like Jose Mourinho is 100% Jose Mourinho 100% of the time. Now there is no alternative basically to him being 100% Jose Mourinho 100% of the time.
Martin, I wanted to ask you about his football, because Johnny touched on it there in terms of knowing what you're going to get off the pitch and on the pitch. In Tom Allnutt's piece, you kind of had a breakdown of his career and his win percentages. Going back to Porto, 72% win percentage, then Chelsea 67, Inter 63, Real Madrid 71. In his second spell at Chelsea, it was still 59%. Even at Manchester United, 58%. So it is that winning football. But do we think he's kind of football, modern football, has slightly passed him by, so that now we see his style of football as, oh, really boring, oh, it's backs to the wall, etc.? Because it wasn't always the case, was it?
In that first
Chelsea team, we were all like, wow, this is amazing.
Well, if you look at it, when Antonio Conte's team was breaking records and everything, the records he was breaking, and later on Pep Guardiola was breaking records at Manchester City, the records being broken were Jose Mourinho at Chelsea for, you know, most wins in this and most goals scored in that and fewest defeats.
Fewest goals conceded.
Incredible statistics. And I was always a fan of Jose Mourinho. And even when he played, you know, football that people didn't like, and the Inter Milan, Inter Milan winning the European Cup, it was a hell of an achievement to win the European Cup with Inter Milan. It really was. And there's a lot of ways to win a football match. And if everyone played the same way, even if it was balancing the ball on your nose, it would still be dull in the end, because everyone's playing the same way. So I quite like this sort of Voldemort character, basically, that is on the dark side as such. Having said that, I watched the Europa League final, and that was a tough old watch, that, that was tough. And then he goes hanging around waiting for the referee, wasn't he, afterwards?
Anthony Taylor
and stuff. And that all...
He was accosted at the airport afterwards.
And what I mean is, there was always, always a dark side to the way Jose would play. There was always a little bit of the dark arts to it. But the other stuff balanced it out. And there's less and less of the stuff that balances it out now. And there's, a lot more of the dark arts. And what you were saying about Roma, you've got to remember that not so long ago, Agnelli... And I know he's sort of a discredited figure, but Agnelli of Juventus was making the case, do Atalanta deserve to be in the Champions League, even though they finished fourth, when a great club like Roma have finished fifth and can't get in there? And was almost making the case that, you should get a bit of a pass for your historic achievements. And the example that he used was Atalanta, small little upstarts, I know you've come fourth, but you're not worthy of this tournament, when a great club like Roma are shut out. Now we're meant to look at Roma and think, well, the Conference League, that's a good level, the Europa League final or whatever. Roma are a big club. They're a big club. Now, they're not Juventus and they're not the Milans, but they're a big club. And, Jose does this as well. He sort of changes what people, everything becomes. Jose was the guy that made everyone take the Community Shield seriously as a trophy, because he started listening in his trophies one. He took it seriously. And now we all sort of accept it like that. We go, they've won the first trophy of the season, when in the past that was the Charity Shield. It was, I think I've got it in my contract that I'd never have to go. That was after Blackburn versus
Very
Everton.
We'll bring that up at the start of next season. Gregor, in terms of Mourinho and that personality and some of those clubs that Martin mentioned, and you keep saying, he's a big club, and Tottenham before them were a big club, and Manchester United was arguably the biggest. That was the big project, wasn't it? And he was seen to be brought in to compete against City and Guardiola. Does he almost need to now rebrand and find a club a little bit lower down the pecking order and channel some of that kind of upstart personality that he had, which was part of the Inter Milan on the pitch at the Nou Camp. We've done it. We've knocked you off your pedestal, etc.
Has he not already done that? Has he not already had the first stage of that? Maybe there's another stage to come. I mean, he did that with Spurs. And, like, let's not forget, if he hadn't been sacked, you might have won a trophy for, with
yeah,
Spurs.
Oh, mate, they sacked him at a ridiculous time.
Exactly, he would tell you that, and I think he has done. Yeah. And he won, you know, he said to the fans outside, we'll always have Tirana, where they won their first trophy in 14 years. Mm. So he still finds a way to win or nearly win.
He did it at Porto. He won the European Cup at Porto. Mm. I mean, you know.
But the bigger picture now is that, like, I actually read that he's... points per game ratio is the lowest of any Roma coach with 50 or more games. So, and his last press conference, there was a good line. He said, again, he's always like, you know, creating a siege mentality or whatever. He's saying that Roma are not among the teams who should be finishing in the top four. That's what he said. Yeah. And then he said, they must think I call myself Jose Harry Mourinho Potter. So, you know, they're still like, it's box office, but it's always like, us against the world, to you know, lofty expectations, and that can be quite grinding. It was certainly grinding for Spurs. Look, I don't know the kind of culture, and it's going to be different. And obviously, it's different in Rome. They loved it. They loved the fact that he was a winner, a serial winner. Mm. But that became really great in it for a team like Spurs. So it's got to be a pretty specific kind of project, I think, for a club to really buy into what Jose Mourinho now brings.
Mm. He's 60 now, Martin. Just finally. He always talked about when he was at Chelsea a kind of career trajectory that maybe saw him finish in international football. Do you see it kind of going that way, or maybe the millions and billions of maybe Saudi Arabia or elsewhere? Or do you think he'll kind of have another crack at a big club, as you say?
It's just where that comes from. People have said, oh, he could go to Newcastle or whatever, but Newcastle, one of the reasons that, you know, with Manchester City, one of the reasons Guardiola was of such appeal to Manchester City was because his style of football is popular, it's pleasing on the eye, it wins friends. Imagine if Manchester City had 115 charges against them and Diego Simeone as their manager, you know, and it, every game was, you know, chaos and carnage and people getting sent off or threatened and this was like, imagine that. The saving grace with Manchester City is that you watch them come back from behind at Newcastle, you go, God, I haven't seen a team play like this all season. This is fantastic. And that's the saving grace, because otherwise if it was, you know, if it was all dark arts or whatever, you know, Harry Potter, used with Harry Potter, you know, that's what they've got. Man, so you've got Harry Potter in charge, and do you really want Voldemort? You know, that is the thing. If you're Newcastle, you're looking to, you're trying to win friends. People call it sports washing, and I think we sort of rather inflate our own importance in the idea of sports washing. But you're trying to win friends. You're trying to project a certain image. Eddie Howe fits that perfectly. Great work ethic. Mm. He's a young English coach and stuff like that. If you've got someone poking people in the eye in the dugout, as he has been known to do, is that really going to win you too many friends around the world? Oh, we've got the manager who pokes people in the eye when they're not looking.
Well, we will see if there can be a Jose Mourinho rebrand. There you go, Game Podcast listeners. Solutions to football's financial problems and comparisons of Harry Potter and Pep Guardiola. You've got the full lot on this show. Jonathan Northcroft, Martin Samuel and Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. We'll be back on Monday. See you then.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.